Okay, so we are hopefully finishing up Parakhet, chapter 8. We saw the Jews launch their war against Ai, the instructions that Yahushua gave them. We had our complex map of who exactly was located where last week. I see you brought back the bowls, so we could...
I think we're missing a few.
Yeah, we'll see how this works.
We'll give a half or two.
We'll figure it out. We can take out the oranges also out of the bowl. But what we need to do now is see the execution of the war, the aftermath of the war, and then the section that's put in at the end of the parak that's kind of odd, that doesn't really seem to fit, in which the Jews create a bris, a covenant with Hashem, as we'll get to. So we're up to Psukim Yud Chet Tzuchav Vav, 18 to 26. They've set up all of the different ambushes. Yahushua went into the valley, whether that was meant to broadcast to the people of Ai, I'm coming closer, it's time for you now to get ready to attack, or whether that was to show the Jews that he's not afraid, however you read that. The morning arrives, Yahushua's group approaches the city, the people of the city come out to attack them, Lamoed, we talked about the different meanings of Lamoed. Yahushua's group turns around and Bayinagu, they are struck, either literally, or they pretend to be struck, they flee, the people in the city come racing after them, and nobody, we're told no man at any rate, in Pasuk Yud Zayin, remains in Ai, or even in Beit El, because Beit El sees them and also comes out to attack, and that brings us to Pasuk Yud Chet, sentence 18. Vayomer Hashem al Yoshua, we'll read this straight and then tackle it. But Vayomer Hashem al Yoshua, God says to Yoshua, Nitevak Bakidon Asher Biacha El Ha'ai. Extend your kidon. Kidon is some kind of a staff that he is holding. So extend the staff that is in your hand towards Ai. Kiviyadcha etnena, because I'm going to put Ai into your hands. Vayet Yoshua Bakidon Asher Biado El Ha'ir, and Yoshua extends the scepter towards the city. V'ha'orev kama meheram mimakomo v'yarutsu kintos yado v'yavau ha'ir v'yil kedua. And the ambush comes from its place and runs when Yahushua extends his arm. They come to the city, they conquer the city. So in other words, extending the scepter is the signal for them. You know, how they see him, how far away they are, good questions all. But apparently they're able to see, maybe there are signalers along the way, I don't know. But they're able to see that the signal has been given, and they enter the city, which we know is empty, they conquer it. Vayimaharu vayatzisu es ha'ir ba'esh, they rush, and they light the city on fire. Vayifnu anshei ha'ai achareihem, and the people of Ai turn around. Vayiru, and they see, v'hinei ala ashan ha'ir ha'shamayma, and lo and behold, their city is in flames. Smoke is ascending up to the heavens. V'lohaya v'hem yadayim lonus heina v'heina, and they lacked, at that point, they lacked the means, literally the hands, but it means the strength, to run here, to run there, right? What do? Do you go back? Do you go forward? What do you do at that point? V'ha'am hanos hamidbar ne'apachal harodef, and the nation, meaning the Jews we're now talking about, who had been running, fleeing from Ai towards the wilderness, Nepachal Harodev. Now they turn around on the people of Ai who had been pursuing them. V'Yoshua v'chol Yisrael ra'u kilachad ha'orevis ha'ir. So Yoshua and all of Israel see that the ambush has taken the city. V'chiala ha'shan ha'ir, and the smoke is coming up from the city. V'yashuvu v'yaku es anshei ha'ai. And so they turn around, and they all strike the people of Ai. V'eila yatzu min ha'ir l'krasam. And these, meaning the people of the ambush, who had burned the city, they, yatzu min ha'ir l'krasam, they come out of the city to greet them also. So everybody is surrounding this group. And they were for Israel in the middle, Tavech like Toch. They are in the middle, all the camps of the Jews around them from the various sides. And they strike them, nobody escapes. And they capture the king of Ai alive. And they bring him to Yahushua. And it was when Israel had concluded killing all of the residents of Ai who were out in the field who had come running after them. In the wilderness where they, the people of Ai, had pursued the Jews. And all of them were struck by the sword until they were all gone. So at that point, all Israel returned to Ai, and they struck it by the sword. The death toll that day, from man to woman, indicating that there were women who were killed as well. 12,000. All of Anshei Ha'ai. My inclination is to assume this means all of the people rather than males, because we've specified Ad Isha, that it's 12,000 people in Ai, all gone. Last sentence in this section. Yehoshua never put down that staff, that scepter, until they had destroyed all of the residents of Ai. Completely done. Questions on that section, rather long section that we just read. Yeah?
Well, just a few things just seem odd. Like, first of all, so all of a sudden, this group comes towards Ai, and all of a sudden they start chasing him to go, oh, yeah, we can't do that. Hey, actually, we'll turn around and we'll come get you. Like, first of all, that seems to me a little, if they were capable, I know it was the whole plan to come out to draw them out, but it just seems funny, like, all of a sudden they'll just turn around and be like, hey, surprise, we're going to come get you now. That seemed weird to me.
Okay.
And also, you have here, they say that they kill them, lefi charev ad tumam, and then all of a sudden, until they're all dead, and then they go back to Ai, and they kill them all until they're dead. It's a little repetitive, or are they now killing the women and children who are left there? I don't know what that is.
I also think just 12,000 doesn't seem like a large number to me at all. Like, maybe, I don't know. First of all, they sent 3,000 to begin with, but 12,000 is including women, children, you know, everybody. Why is it such a tremendously big city that's such a threat? Like, does that seem logical? I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
What else?
First of all, they burnt the whole city, right? So is there any cherem left? Is it all destroyed? Like, weren't they supposed to take the cherem?
And in the Torah, when we see that Moshe had to keep his arms up and they would win and arms down and they would lose, and they needed someone to come and support their arms, how is Yehoshua holding this up the whole time? Is there any more detail about that? How long? This couldn't have taken 5 minutes.
I don't know how long it took. In Moshe, it's described as being all day.
You know, maybe the one
more than all, less than all day, killing 12,000 people.
I honestly have no idea.
Seems like he kept it all the time.
Also, doesn't it say like they killed everybody and they burnt the city, and then it says they go back into the city and then they kill them again? Like, it seems like.
Where does it say that?
Yeah, that's what.
Like in Pasuk.
The Pichar, that's what the
Moshe
said.
Yeah, like in Pasuk, Kaf Dalet.
In Chaf Dalet, it's the people in the field.
Okay.
Then they go back to Ai and they strike it by the sword.
But I guess wasn't the city already burned? Like, wasn't everyone gone from the city from beforehand?
So my assumption is that burning a city is not a terribly effective way to actually destroy the population in those days.
I see.
Meaning, you're talking about people who, being in the Middle East, are... we can guess. I didn't research it, what their building materials are. They certainly have wood at their disposal, but it's not necessarily the exclusive material. The houses are not huge houses. You know, we're talking about small, you know, relatively small residences here for them. You know, people run out of the house, and now they may have lost their stuff, but they're alive. That would be my assumption.
But I thought
there
was no one left in the city. That's what I'm saying.
So the men.
But you think that the women and children
all the
didn't go out to fight?
So you're saying these people are killing are the men and the women and children?
Whoever stayed behind.
Yeah.
Whoever stayed behind. I also am leery of the word "kol." Every time we see the word "all," I sort of wonder if that's meant to say this was this group.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean literally every man was accounted for and had gone out to war. I'm not sure you need to believe that kol means everything, and therefore it's possible that there are some men who are left behind. The point is, though, that their basic fighting force is out of the city, and therefore it's easy for the ambushers to come in. They light things on fire. They don't kill people. They light things on fire. They leave. Mm-hmm. Going back to Ora's question from before, it's not just that the people who are out of the city are going to be defeated by Yehoshua's group that have turned around. Because we also have the ambushers who were the northwest part of the city. Right? If you remember the way that this worked, we said that the city's entrance is the north side, right? Mm-hmm. So, set it up again. This is the city, okay? Here's the city. Where are you going to say, which way is north in this house?
That way.
North is that way. Okay, so the city's entrance is here, right? Yoshua's group is here. And then you have a northwest ambush, you have a southwest ambush, and you have Yericho over here, right?
And Beit El is over
here. And Beit El is here where the muffins are, right? Yeah. So what you're looking at now is the people come out of the city to attack. You have Yoshua's group here that have been running away, and they turn around and say, wait, we don't need to run away. You have this ambush group meant to join with Yehoshua to attack. Plus, you have this flank part of Yehoshua's group that was identified also, that was sort of attached to Yehoshua's group that's here. And then this group burns the city and then comes out to attack.
So where's Beit El and all this? They've also come
out. Beit El, correct. When they first pursued Yehoshua here, and Beit El saw what was going on and saw these guys also, so they come out this way. I don't know exactly where they are at the point when the city goes up in flames. But at this point, they're already committed.
Why are they so attacked? Like, are they so close to,
so
they're being attacked, they go out and fight?
They're physically very close, meaning we consistently find that description going back to Abraham's time of Bein Beit El uVein HaAi, the idea that, yes, they're very close together. But also, as we're going to see in a big way in the ninth parak, and going further in Yehoshua, there is this sense of sort of invaders are coming to our land, we are going to bond together. You know, sort of what we saw with Midian and Moab, right, in Parshas Balak, where they combine forces as well. It is something that they do, yes. So, you know, whether they have a formal defense pact, you know, a NATO type of a deal, I don't know. But yeah, they come out to attack as well, and they're here. And now they're being attacked from all directions.
Didn't they hide their king? Obama goes to the state or whatever. You don't bring the king.
Oh, that's the next question.
Yeshua led, I guess, this time. You know,
right.
He was there. Usually, like in Jewish tradition, the king leads them.
Right. So we're going to have to talk about this king. We're not done with this king yet.
Where did he go? They brought him to Yeshua, and then what?
Well, next what is coming next. You'll see.
Oh, okay.
If you want to peek at Pasuk Chavchet, you'll find out. But we're getting there. But the king is a good question. So what's happening here, right, is that these people are surrounded. The people who come out of the city are, in fact, surrounded because the various ambushes have taken up their positions, west and south. East is Yericho, and therefore there's no escape that way. And they're frozen in the middle. And at that point, they don't know what to do. Their city is in flames, and it's too late for them. That's how they end up being defeated. Now, the question of, well, there are only 12,000 of them, is true. And that's what motivated the beginning of the Perek, right? When the scouts came back and said, ah, come on, what do you need? You know, you need a couple of thousand people for them. It was precisely that point. It didn't work out that way, you know. But the reason it didn't work out that way is because we lacked protection from Hashem, right? Because of the Averim, we said it wasn't that God was punishing them specifically, but He was saying, I'm not going to protect you then. You send out 3,000 people, you know, what's the ratio within a city of 12,000? How many of them are fighting? I don't know, but you could probably assume 4,000 or 5,000. So they're routed. They never, it could be they didn't even expect resistance after what happened in Yericho. So that's in terms of that. In terms of the redundancy, I don't think that it's actually redundant. I think that what you get is, in Pasuk Chaf Bet, it talks about the people who left the city and are now stuck in the middle, and it says they strike them until there's nobody left, and they take the king of Ai. And then in Chaf Dalet, it says, when they finished with what they did in Chaf Bet, wiping out the people who are out in the field, then they returned to Ai, which is on fire. They destroy whoever is left in Ai, still in Pasuk Chaf Dalet. In Chaf Hei, we get the tally. In Chaf Vav, we're told that Yehoshua has kept his hand up the entire time with this signal of the Kidon.
What's the significance of that?
Ah, so what is the significance of the Kidon? This is a really good question. I want to go back to the beginning of the section, though. I want to know, first, what happened in Pasuk Yudchet. Suddenly, Hashem is intervening. Right? We made a big deal about all these military plans.
Yehoshua did it. He didn't even go last time, right?
first time, correct.
First time.
He was rebuked for that.
Right. So it's almost like he tried to be the leader and send his army, and he failed.
That's why he slept in the middle of the camp.
And now, right, like, unless it's God saying, okay, I'm with you and you're going to win, you have no chance. It's almost like, well
is it?
They have the whole plan. Everything they've done, right? They're set up to go. Like, everything's
ready. But you think if he was a warrior, he would go out to fight.
He has to do that Kitan thing.
Right? Holds his arms up.
Right.
Like,
so what's the answer? It's a symbol. I mean, well, the scepter is a practical signal. In other words,
it's a spear, by the way.
Yeah, and you could take Kidon as some kind of a staff. Don't think royal scepter like Ahasuerus in the throne room, no. I'm calling it some kind of a weapon, I think, is accurate. Kidon is used elsewhere in Tanakh also. It's not only used here. I think there's something else that's going on. Remember that since the beginning of the Sefer, we've stressed the idea that the Jews are confident in Yehoshua because Hashem is with him. It's never supposed to be Yehoshua doing it himself. It's supposed to be Hashem making this happen on behalf of Yehoshua, working through Yehoshua. So the partnership that they had lost is now repaired. The partnership they lost in their first battle with Ai is now made whole. Yeah, the question of who would have seen this, who would have known it, is an interesting one. In other words, we assume when Hashem tells Yehoshua, pick up the Kidon, that doesn't mean that everybody else hears it. It's a voice to Yehoshua. Everybody else just thinks that, Yehoshua gave the signal. But maybe he tells them that, and that's how they're, aware, I don't know. But the thing that you can't really miss here, if you take a look at source number one, I gave you a reference to a pasuk in Parshas Beshalach. For those who have a Tanakh, take a look. It's an important parallel, I think. So there, in that pasuk, the Jews are standing at the sea, and Hashem tells Moshe, right? Neteyas yadcha, haremes matcha, neteyas yadcha al hayam. Right? He tells him to extend his mateh, right, that staff that he had, over the sea, and the sea will split. You see the parallel? I think it's fairly clear, no? Hashem is telling him to engineer a miracle by picking up this staff. Here, Hashem is telling him to engineer what may be a miraculous victory, although it's through human means, by picking up the staff. We've spent a lot of time talking about how Hashem is going to do miracles for Yehoshua as he did them for Moshe. Right? As I was with Moshe, so I will be with you. Hashem has said multiple times, I will elevate you, and so on. So that I think what we're meant to do is see a parallel here. I don't think it's accidental. I think it's on purpose. Ramban has a comment, which I'm not sure I would apply here, in which he says that in general, miracles happen via, or nevuah comes true, I should say, via human action. That you do something, and that's sort of the focal point on which the nevuah will come true. So that when Hashem says to Moshe, pick up the staff and hit the sea, that's actually the focal point that then allows the miracle to come through of the sea splitting. Or you have Nevi'im who are told, Yechezkel especially, to do acts that represent the miracle that's about to take place. or the Nevuah that's about to happen, the prophecy that he's going to present. So I wonder if there isn't that element here of sort of shaking his weapon at the people, and then the Jews are going to be able to strike at the people of Ai. I wonder if that's relevant here as well. But the simple basic read here, I think, is that we're meant to see the partnership repaired between Hashem and Yehoshua, and represented by this lifting of the staff, whether it's a miraculous thing that he's able to hold it on his own all day, or whether it's because he's not just sitting on a rock, he's actually riding around. I don't know. But he's able to do this.
But he doesn't physically go out and fight, he just...
Right, apparently he's holding a stick, which makes it hard to fight. If you take a look... Yeah. If you take a look at Psukim Yutet Techaf, you get one of the ways that we know that we have these multiple ambushes. Now, we read it into the Psukim of the setup last week, but it's also here in the actual battle. If you look at Pasuk Yutet, it says, V'ha'orev kama mehera mimekomo. The orev, the ambush, rose quickly from its place. V'yarutsu, and they ran when he extended his hand. It's gone into plural form. V'yavo'u ha'ir, and they came to the city. V'yamaru, and they rushed, and so on. Why wasn't it v'orev kamu in the first place? So the answer suggested is because it's actually two different ambushes that are being described. So that's the idea. If you take a look on your sheet, I think I brought you, take a look at source number 2. I brought you the Malbim's full description. I didn't know when I wrote up the sheet that we were going to be able to, duplicate the whole map. So map's a little redundant. Nonetheless, Nimsa ata hayu mukafim mikol arba ruchosam. Now it turns out that the people of Ai were surrounded from all four directions. Ki machane Yisrael hikifa osam mitzad Safon umitzad machane Yoshua, umitzad marav kimin gam. Yoshua's camp bounded them on the north and west side, like a gamma. V'ha'orev b'knegdam mitzad darom. And then you had the ambush, people who had lit up the city, coming from the south, where the city was. Vitzad mizrach ha'patuach ha'yeneged yiricha. And the eastern side of the city is open, the eastern side of where they're standing is open, but it's opposite Yericho, shekvar haya tachas memshala Yisrael, which was already under Jewish control. And remember, we've seen this from Malbim consistently in this parak. Malbim stressed it a few times last week. That we see here the military wisdom of Yehoshua. He says, it's fundamental in your military planning to surround the enemy on all sides.
Was this Yehoshua's military planning?
So, good question.
That he had to fail once to become a better planner?
I don't think so.
Why did he plan to do, or was it God who told him to do this?
Okay, so we have three questions.
They already did that once, and they got defeated.
One second. We have three questions. Question number one, is this his plan? The answer is that when Hashem spoke to Yoshua, he said, and place an ambush. We don't know if there were more details in the conversation. Malbim is clearly assuming that the layout of who goes where and how is all Yoshua's instruction. Because otherwise he couldn't say what he said here. So that's number one. Malbim is assuming that it really is Yehoshua. Number two, in terms of the question of why didn't he do this last time, my assumption would be he didn't do it last time because he had been told, this is easy, don't worry about it, it's a small city, nothing to worry about, and so he said, okay, fine, so we'll attack from the front and be done with it. This is a whole three-day effort, remember. We talked about last time, it took them 3 days to set up for this. This is not, this is not the way Jews are used to doing things under Yahushua and under Moshe. We just attack, and the people opposite us collapse. Tika, your question had been?
Why didn't they just go in the front door?
Right, and I think the answer is that now that they're there and they've seen what it was like to fight them the first time, I think there's a sense that we need to do things a little differently. Even though the first time was seen as...
It's so dramatic, though, probably.
Yeah.
The ambushes.
Yeah, it's very dramatic. That's great.
Well, is this a small city?
I don't know.
So it is a small city compared to the size of the Jews.
Right. There were millions, I thought.
Yeah. So compared to the Jews as a whole, it is a very small city.
You saw a million people walking down the road coming towards your city. That would scare you.
Yes. I mean, keep in mind that most of them are camped at Yericho. Mm-hmm.
Which is just over there.
Well, Yericho is about to lose.
Over there, that's Beit El. Beit El just lost Yericho.
Oh, that was right. Yeah, Yericho's over there. It was Beit El that lost the moment. It's true. I don't know how much they could see from there and how much they could not. Abarbanel had made the point we saw a couple of weeks ago that it's a fortress city. It's up on a hill, and it's not so simple to take.
Well, we said there's a valley in front of it.
There's a valley in front of it, and then you have to ascend to actually get to to the city. So that does make it harder to conquer. The problem I have with Malbim, and with our story in general, is that we've seen, when we did our discussion about ethnic cleansing before the third parak, we saw that there was a mitzvah identified of leaving a side open for the enemy to flee. Whether that's a good strategy, because it means they won't fight as hard for their lives, they'll be busy thinking about running away, or whether it's actually an act of mercy, Ramban brought both ideas. We said you're supposed to leave part open.
They
don't seem to.
Well, it was open. They just had us. I mean, it was open to Yeriko. They just wouldn't want to go that way.
Right. That's not open. That's, yeah. Open means they can get away.
Well, then how much space is there between Yeriko and I? Like, isn't there conceivably, they didn't have any troops over on that side?
I don't know.
Everybody, you know, or were they allowed to let some go? Like, that was also a question.
Right. So, right. Right. So, depending on whether people choose to make peace with them or not. But I think it's a good question. In other words, what are the rules when you're fighting the Canaan nations? Is that rule of leave a side open meant for this type of war or not? We talked about it a little bit when we went through the discussion, but I don't remember the conclusion then. It appears that Malbim is of the belief that they're not supposed to leave a side open on this. So, note one other point. In Pasuk Tedvav, we noted, somebody pointed it out, that the Pasuk actually says, Chafav, that it says Yoshua does not put his hand down until it's all over. In other words, he stays at the battlefield. Not only was he with them, he's with them the entire time. All the way to the end. Barbanel makes that point. Okay, so now let's see what happens with the king, because this king has been captured alive, and we have to talk about him. Unfortunately, he's not going to be happy with what we're going to say. Psukim Chav Zayin Chav Tet, sentences 27 to 29. Rak ha-behema u'shlal ha'ir ha'hi bazizu lahem Yisrael. Only the animals and the spoils, there answers your question, Alina, the spoils of that city did the Jews take, kidvar Hashem asher tzivas Yoshua, like Hashem told Yoshua, this is fine, they're allowed to do it. Vayisrov Yoshua es ha'ai, so Yoshua, and what it means there is either it means his instruction that he had given to the forces, or it means that after the war is over, he goes in and makes sure they do a proper job of it. They burn the city. I suppose the answer would be this is a second burning, because that would explain how they had spoils to take. Right? Right? The answer is the first time was not to the ground. The first time was just enough to frighten the soldiers who have all left the city and panic them. That was the first time. Now, this is a real burning. He makes it a tail. A tail is a mound. So he makes it a mound eternally. Shimama, desolation, ad hayom hazeh, until this very day. And as we've said before, ad hayom hazeh could mean until the time that the Sefer is recorded, could mean until the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, could mean it's meant to be forever. The Gemara in Yuma discusses how we take ad hayom hazeh. It's not clear how it's meant to be taken. I don't know. Well, you know. You know where it is. You've got Beidel over there.
I know, but meaning, do we... So is it not built up now?
So I don't know.
Obviously somebody's on it.
No? I don't know.
I mean, you have to go look east of Beidel. I mean, we're going to see a little bit about what happens to Ai after this, and it may indirectly give us an answer to that question. V'yazmelech ha'ai tala al ha'etz ad eis ha'aref. And the body of the king of Ai was suspended on a tree. Now, important to note, that doesn't mean they hanged him. Generally speaking, what you find in Tanakh when they talk about putting a body on wood, what they mean is they executed somebody and then they put the body out for display. That's what they're talking about.
Come across things and they put him on some wood.
Well, they didn't have original ideas. So they took the body, they put it out on the wood, ad eis ha'arev, until the evening. Uchavah Hashemesh tzivah Yehoshua vayoridu es niblasam en ha'etz. At sunset, Yehoshua instructed them and they took down the body. Vayashlichu osa al pesach shar ha'ir. They threw it towards the entrance of the city of Ai. Vayakimu alav gal avanim gadol ad hayom hazeh. And they put a large pile of stones on it until this very day. Questions?
Well, not everybody can see it.
Why would they put it there?
Three different killings.
What do you mean? Why three different?
Well, apparently, so they killed him first, then they hung him up.
Yeah. And then they buried him. No, they buried him under a pile of stones. Is that Roberta, you were going to say?
Why would they put him at the big entrance of the city? There's nobody there.
Why do you need to put him on a tree?
Well, why not just kill him and, like, they killed the other 12,000 people with the cherub and that's it?
Right. Why are we doing this? What's the game about?
Is it trying to show other cities? Well, they hear about it, probably.
They come along later and they see his big pile of stones and they know the story. Maybe. So that's one question, is the fate of the king. The other is the fate of the city. Right? What's this business about not rebuilding it? Yericho, we had reasons. Right? Yericho, we said, don't rebuild it because, and we gave any number of reasons. Right? The conquest was on Shabbos, it was the first of their conquests, the city was a holy city, all sorts of different explanations. It was like an Eir HaNidachas, a city that worships idols. We gave all sorts of explanations, none of which apply to Ai.
Did
it
worship idols?
Didn't all the cities worship idols?
I don't know. We have a language. We saw in the parak regarding Yericho and parak Vav that we had a language there that actually matched the language of Eir HaNidachas in the Torah, the city that worships idols. We don't have that language in this section. It's a very strange thing that they're doing. So, first of all, in terms of not rebuilding it, Metsudat Zion, actually, and I believe that's Rav David Altshuler, who also did Metsudat David, says actually it wasn't a command. It's not like Yericho, where there's a curse, like, cursed is whoever builds the city up and all that, like, don't build the city. He says it's simply a description of the devastation. They destroyed the city so thoroughly that it became a ruin, and it is a ruin to this very day. It's not a mitzvah of don't be built. Yeah, it could be rebuilt. This happens to, he's just describing what happened. That's the way that Metsudat Zion takes it. And frankly, it's good that he says that. If you take a look at Ezra Perek Bet, Pasuk Chaf Chet in your Tanakh, chapter 2, sentence 28, towards the end. Ezra Nechemiah Divrei Hayamim. It's important to flip the pages at the end of the Tanakh, too. Sorry, what page? 1816. That's the one. Chapter 2, sentence 28.
Sorry, again? Chapter
2, sentence 28. Everyone see it?
Yeah.
This is the time of the second Beis Hamikdash. Right? Ezra's the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash. And he's giving you a catalog of populations. And look who's there.
Beidil
and I.
Not a lot of people.
How many people are there?
323.
Okay. But there are people there. There are people in Ai. So how do I understand that? You told me that it's not rebuilt.
Did they destroy Beidil?
No. But what about...
It says
Ai
too.
Sorry?
It says Yericha. Is Yericha.
Yes. So when we learned about Yericha, we saw that other pasuk and said, well, wait a minute, it looks like that Yericha was rebuilt. And we gave different answers for that question. Remember, we talked about maybe they built up a section of it and that's not called building up the city, or it was on a different spot. Or we gave all the different answers then. So,
Beidel and I were kind of combined. And maybe they're just referred to as one. And there wasn't really anyone living in Ai, but...
Kind of like, we still refer to it like Gush Katif.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, you're saying two different things. But,
It's almost like they're one, but they have two names. You know, there really were two cities, but because they were so close, they kind of get referred to together, and...
Maybe they weren't really living in
Ai. We basically have two answers to this. Right? One answer is to take the approach of Metsudat Zion, which is to say that there was no command of don't rebuild the city. It was simply a description of the desolation, but by the time of Ezra, in the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash, there was a population again living in Ai. That's one answer. The second answer will encompass the various answers you can give and say, Ai was not settled, but there was a population living right near Ai. know, they were next door, they were in Beit El, they were the people who were from Ai original. Whatever answer you choose to give, although how it will be the people who were in Ai originally, I don't know, because we seem to think they're all gone. But
maybe some ran to Beit El.
I'm sorry?
Maybe some ran to Beit El.
Maybe. The point is that you have to deal with this pasuk in Ezra, but it's not a game-changing pasuk. You can give different answers to explain it.
Isn't this the Jewish people? This isn't the people who came back?
No, it is Jews, right? So you're not going to say it's the population from there originally. That's true. Yeah, no, it is Jews. Correct. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, Abarbanel assumes that it was actually a mitzvah of don't rebuild this city. He says in source 4, I didn't bring it on the sheet. What Abarbanel writes, and I'll tell it to you outside of Abarbanel, is that it was meant as a signal to other cities. We're going to leave this as a ruin so that everybody sees what we've done and they won't oppose us. That was the idea. The question, right, so the question then is, well, not so much when you already did it with Yericho, but the question that stands is, why didn't you issue a curse? With Yericho, there was actually a curse against whoever rebuilds it. You didn't do that here. So Barbanel suggests it's because the city wasn't really worthy of it. It's a smaller city. It's not as big a thing. It's just that he's making a statement. It is odd, though, because you already did it in Yericho. It's kind of redundant, nonetheless. So that brings us to the king's body and what kind of a game we're playing here with this, you know, executing him and then hanging him, the body. So Abarbanel gives an answer. If you take a look, and now we're in source number 4. He says, Sha'al ha'ma'at yikre she'yitafsu ha'melech, she'yitbisu ha'melech b'milchama. He says, it's rare that you actually catch the king in the war. Either he runs away, or he dies, and he borrows from a pasuk here, on the lofty field. Right? Meaning, either the king is going to escape. Whether escape from the field of battle, or escape because he never went out to war in the first place. However you do that. Or he's going to die in battle. Right? And if you remember the story with Shaul, right, Shaul tries to have his armor bearer kill him to avoid being captured by the Plishtim. So normally you don't catch the king. That's why Yehoshua made a point. When he catches a king, he suspends the body of the king. So that people will see them from afar on that day when their body is out there. V'yakiru v'yedu ki ha-melechu. And they're going to know, this is the king. Im li Yisrael kulo she'yismechu b'rosam oso taloy al hanes. Whether so that the Jews would be happy when they see this, they'll be confident in their victory. V'es ha'ayvim ha-lochamim gam kein she'yirach l'vavam b'rosam ha-melech hukam al. Or for the enemy who is fighting to be intimidated, for their hearts to become soft when they see the king suspended above. Abarbanel again borrowing a pasuk phrase, hukam al. Nisleke achar hapechusim, seeing the king's body hanging there like the body of some peasant or some lowly person. That's the idea. That's the idea here in suspending the body. It's meant to be a statement, because it was rare that you actually captured the other king. This was indeed, as was pointed out, unusual. Obviously, the king wouldn't be terribly happy about it, but that's the way it goes when you lose the war. So, that's why he's displaying the body, but he only displays it for a day. We make a point of him taking it down before sunset, right? That was specified. Why take it down before sunset?
You don't want to brag.
Yes, you do. Sorry. Because it's gross. Okay.
Sorry. Don't we have a rule that the body can only hang so it's the image of God and you shouldn't shame it?
Right. So we do indeed have a rule. Although the rule is stated specifically regarding people killed in a Beit Din. When you have to carry out capital punishment, make sure the body is buried the same day. Yes. But source number 5, Radak says that this actually is applied beyond just the case of those killed in Beit Din. Source 5. Kemosha kasublo salin nivla sa'ala eitz. Like the Pasuk says, you shall not leave his corpse upon the wood. V'alkol ha'nisleh be'eretz Yisrael, mitzvat ha'katuv. The instruction is for anybody who is suspended like this, whose body is put on display in the land of Israel. Why do you have to take it down? Is it just because it's gross? So we get, well, that's a legitimate explanation. We get three different approaches. First of all, the approach brought, or two approaches really, come from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. This is a difficult Gemara to understand. The pasuk that they quote is the one which says that you're supposed to take the body down. The pasuk continues to say, why do you not leave the body out? The ki kilalat elokim talui, which is a very hard phrase to translate. I translated it here the way the Gemara seems to take it. It will be a curse to God to leave this person suspended, to leave the body out there. The word kilalat is an interesting word. We actually just did this in the Eov Shir. We have various terms in the Torah for cursing. There is arur, which is one of the classic ones. There is kuf lamed lamed, like used over here. There are a couple of others as well. The term kilalat, according to Malbim, is a term for not just cursing, but despising, taking something lightly, from the word kal. And he says that the double lamed is meant to strengthen it, like to really despise. That's what Malbim writes. So think about that as you read what the Gemara does with this. Klomar. What this means to say is, Mipnei mazet talui. Why is this body suspended? Meaning people are going to ask, why is this person's body suspended? Mipnei shebirech es Hashem. Because he blasphemed against God. Whether that's literally the crime that caused the person to get executed or not is beside the point. V'nimtza shem shamayim mischalel. What's going to happen is people are going to say, why was this person killed? Because they violated a command of God. And keep in mind, in order to carry out the death penalty, you have to have somebody who knew that that was what he was going to get and said, I'm going to do this anyway. I'm doing it intentionally, knowing that that is my penalty. So having the body out there broadcast to the world that somebody didn't care about all these laws and this whole Torah and mitzvot and all of that, it is broadcasting the derision of God. So therefore, he says, Nimtza shem shamayim mitchalel. You're desecrating God's name by having the body out there. On the one hand, putting the body out there tells everybody, you know, if you don't obey, you're gonna have problems. On the other hand, putting the body out there broadcasts to the world, somebody didn't care about all that. And it desensitizes people, potentially, to the crime. So that's the Gemara's first answer. Which wouldn't really work for the king of Ai. That wouldn't really explain why we have to take his body down. Second approach, in this, still in the Gemara, Amar Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir said, "Bishasha adam mitzta'er, shechina malashan omereth." He says, when someone is in pain, what does the shechina say? What does Hashem say? Kalani meiroshi, kalani mizroi. It's a play on the word klala, kilalat, kal. That he says, my kalani may roshi kalani mizroi, which kalani means to be light, right? It's light for me, but the meaning here is understood to be the opposite. It's too much for me to bear, God says. It's terrible for me that this had to happen. In other words, Hashem is pained by the shame that this person is being put through. If God is so upset at the wicked person whose blood is spilled, how much more so for the blood of the righteous? And then the Gemara says, a concluding thought, which you're probably familiar with, not only this, anyone who leaves his corpse, meaning any corpse, not just somebody who's executed in Beis Din, but if a person leaves a body overnight, over below sase, he's violating a biblical prohibition. In other words, this mitzvah is for everybody. However, helino lichvodo, if the body was left out for its own honor. Lahavilo Aron v'tachrichim, such as in order to enable delivery of a coffin, in order to enable delivery of shrouds, if they don't have these otherwise, Eino over Olaf, then he's not transgressing. You can leave the body out, and that's the origin of the practice of delaying a burial, so that, let's say, the person's children are able to arrive there, because that's considered to be for the person's honor. But generally speaking, we avoid delaying. That's this Gemara. So our first approach in the Gemara does not apply to I. Our first approach is that for people to see this person, they're going to now be desensitized to, you know, to committing capital crimes. No one seeing the king of Ai is going to now be desensitized to being the king of a Canaanite nation. So that doesn't really work. But the idea that Hashem is bothered when people are suffering, that will apply for Ai. And then if you look at Ralbag in source number 7, Ralbag offers a third idea. They did not leave his body on of the tree. As the Torah instructs as well regarding people who are executed by the court. Shalola afesh ha'avir. To avoid fouling the air.
Well, because it was gross.
Well, not just that it's gross, but that ecologically, right? We don't want to do this to Israel. That's the idea. Sort of the gross answer, yeah. So what we see here in the execution of this king, and really summing up, I think, not just this, but summing up the lessons going back to the entire round 2 against Ai, is Yehoshua has demonstrated military leadership, both in terms of military strategy and in terms of psychology. The psychology in terms of the Jews and the way he related to them and going down into the valley and being with them, and the psychology of the enemy in terms of figuring out, yeah, they'll come out and so on. And also, what we've seen here is the repair of the relationship with Hashem. Hashem works with him in this victory. That's the upshot of this.
It's also great for his leadership because he failed once. Then he led them into a very, very successful, and now they have trusted him
right
again going forward.
Right. Which I think is a leadership lesson in general.
Mm-hmm. But it also shows every leader isn't perfect.
Right.
You can fail sometimes, but you can overcome it.
Right.
And that's like a good thing. You
know, right.
That they can't expect every time it's going to be a piece of cake.
Right. Okay. Which brings us to the end of the parak. The end of the parak is a problem. The last 6 psukim here. Because we're not clear on when they actually happened. Before we read that, we need to have some background. If you turn in your Tanakh to Devarim Parak Chav Zayin, chapter 27, sentences 1 to 8. Actually, on the sheet I put 1 to 14. Why did I do that? We'll find out. ₪488? Mm-hmm. Thanks. Okay, can someone read aloud from the English?
Moses and the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, "Observe the entire commandment that I command you to this day. It shall be on the day that you cross the Jordan to the land that Hashem your God gives you. You shall set up great stones, and you shall coat them with plaster. You shall inscribe on them the words of this Torah when you cross over, so that you may enter the land that Hashem your God gives you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as Hashem, the God of your forefathers, spoke about you. It shall be that when you cross the Jordan, you shall erect these stones, of which I command you today, on Mount Ebal, and you shall coat them with plaster. There you shall build an altar for Hashem your God, an altar of stones. You shall not raise iron up upon them. Of whole stones shall you build the altar of Hashem your God, and you shall bring upon it burnt offerings to Hashem your God. You shall slaughter peace offerings and eat there, and you shall rejoice before Hashem your God. You shall inscribe on the stones all the words of this Torah well clarified."
That's Pasuk Chet, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the next part will give you the curses and who's where, right? Is that the next piece? The blessings and the curses.
You shall hearken the voice of Hashem, perform all His commandments, His decrees, which I command you today.
Yeah.
That takes you up until Yud. And then the blessings on that museum.
Yeah, and it tells you which Shvatim are where?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I had wanted to see as well. So, read quickly which Shvatim are on Har Gerizim.
So, we've got Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Yosef, and Yamin.
Right.
And Eval, Reuven, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali.
Right. So, where are the Levim?
The Levites shall speak up and say every man of Israel in a loud voice.
They're on Gerizim, it says, but they also speak to them.
Right, they're on Har Gerizim, and they're also in the middle. Right? Does that work? Well, that's part. I mean, that's one issue. The other question is, when is this supposed to happen?
When they cross the Yarden.
When they cross the Yarden. How soon after they cross the Yarden?
Probably right away.
Didn't they build something after they crossed the Yarden already?
They did. They put up stones as a monument, right? That we had seen.
It doesn't say.
But they didn't. Well, the problem is going to be, we'll take a look at
the day that you cross the Jordan. It shall be on the day.
On the day, right. On the day you cross the Yarden. Mm-hmm. But if you take a look quickly at Pasuk Lamed in our Perek, right, chapter 8, sentence 30, what do you find? Uz Yivne Yoshua Mizbeach Lashem Elokei Yisrael. Then Yoshua built. Don't get hung up on the Uz Yivne structure like Uz Yashir. They take it on the simple level that is referring to the building they did at that time. Yoshua built an altar for Hashem, God of Israel, Behar Eval, on Har Eval. And it continues in Pasuk Lamed Aleph. As Moshe had instructed the Jews to do, as is recorded, we just read it, in the Torah of Moshe, a mizbeach of stones, the whole bit, all the instructions, and he wrote on the stones Mishnei HaTorah, and we're going to read it in depth next week. We're not going to wrap this week, apparently. But it's very clear that they think they're doing what they were told to do, but how can it be what they were told to do if they're doing it now?
But maybe it's just in place, you know, in is it in the Navi too, or is it just in the Torah?
So you do have areas of Navi that are transplanted. You do have it. That's possible. But generally speaking, we like to have a reason for transplanting it then. Like, how did this end up here?
Why did it spring? And it's so far away, it's like a few pressure away.
Yeah. So what is that about? We need to also...
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
Right, sorry, to put it down.
Right, I don't know.
Forgot that part. And as was as, maybe it's not directly, you know...
I mean, the Uz is, we generally assume the Uz is normal and we don't get hung up on it. You're going to see it elsewhere in Yoshua also when we get to the 10th parak. We're also going to have to figure out why they're doing this. What exactly is the goal of setting up these stones? What's the purpose? Writing the Torah, plastering the thing with lime? What is the message that's supposed to emerge from it? We're also going to have to figure out where Shevet Levi is. Are they on a mountain or are they not on a mountain? So that's also.
How do they divide them that way? How come some get to be on one and some get to be on?
Well, someone's going to end up
I guess
over there.
Like, could it also. I don't know. I guess we'll get to it more. But, like, just thinking about why it might be here is that it's such a significant act that they wanted to put it in a place where it would be recognized, not just as a, oh, God said you have to go do that, so we did it, but showing, like, more faith in God for what just happened and how he led them, and really it emphasizes this particular act more than it would have if they told it kind of in sequential order.
More grateful. So when it actually happened now, or
no,
is it just recorded?
No, telling
now?
It now. It's not because. Sorry?
I mean, the Yarden is a big miracle.
Right, true. No,
right.
Rico is doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so I think what we're going to do is pause here and come back to this as part of next time, and we'll see. Okay, thank you.